What is up, everybody? Welcome to Lock and Key Unlocked, yeah. A podcast all about Netflix's Lock and Key, the comic book Lock and Key, and everything else. I am Alex.
I'm Justin.
I'm Pete.
And if you are watching on video, you're Gabe. If you're watching on video, either on Crowdcast or on YouTube, as you can see, we are with artist extraordinaire and professional EMT, Gabriel Rodriguez.
A lot of the questions here are going to be medical. I hope you're ready for that.
Yeah. So a couple little orders of business before we get into it. If you are watching on Crowdcast, there's an ask a question button on the bottom. You can actually drop your questions there. We'll try to get to some of those later on in the podcast. If you're watching on YouTube, we'll read through the comments as we go. It's just tricky because it's another window. If you're listening to the audio podcast, don't even worry about it. None of this matters to you whatsoever.
You can whisper a question into your pillow tonight, and that's it.
Quietly.
The other thing that I will mention is this is going to be a full spoiler chat about Lock and Key. We are going to talk about the whole season. Yeah, we're just going to spoil everything. Hopefully nobody actually watched the season. They're just coming and we're going to spoil everything for them. Yep. No, of course not. We had you on, I want to say, it was a couple of weeks before the show debuted, Gabriel. And obviously, of course, you were very hesitant to talk about things then.
Smart. Well played. Yeah. Well played. Got to get it.
Let's start off with an easy one. Let's start off with a simple one. What on your end has this experience been like now that you've gone through the premiere, the launch? It's a month plus change afterwards.
Yeah.
How'd that all go for you? What was that like?
It went incredibly well. It was when right before the view of the show, I think when I talked to you the first time, I hadn't seen the entire season yet.
Yes, I think that's right.
Half of it.
Yeah.
And even though I knew certain things that were going to happen in the very ending, I wasn't sure how the chapters 6, 7, and 8 were going to be. And then after I took to you, I got to see the entire season a couple of days before the release on Netflix, like 5 or 6 days before, right when they finished the final visual effects. So I got the chance to see the entire thing again with my family, with my kid. And when I saw the reaction of other people that wasn't that familiar with the story and the way in which the entire season flow and everything, I was like very happy with it. I knew what the showrunners, the crew wanted to do with the series. And when I saw the final result, I realized that they actually achieved what their goal was with this adaptation. So I was very happy because of that. And I was very confident that it was going to be a very solid vision of this story. I was very aware that it was going to be very different from the comic, and which is something that I appreciate. I think there's no point to tell the same story twice in different medium if you're going to try something, a creative challenge with something like that in an adaptation. For me, the part of the point of it is to do it differently in order to have the chance to reach a different audience and to explore the story in different ways. Also, as you have tools that you don't have in comics as a storytelling medium to drive the story in a different way. So I was very happy and I was very excited, and I got really surprised by the tremendous amount of support that the series got.
Yeah, huge.
It ran really well in the Netflix platform in which we started having this ranking in each country.
Yeah, it was in the ranking for a while. It was great.
So, yeah, I was confident that the series was going to do good, but I think it did even better than we ever expected it to be. So I was really happy and excited.
Yeah, I know you were posting a lot of these pictures on social and things, but Netflix obviously is a global company, and the fact that they built giant head key mazes in malls everywhere and everything.
Yes. Yeah.
What's it like when you see something like that? That somebody, the TV show is one thing. Clearly they're building, Key House and building out Matheson in this case instead of Lovecraft, but you're seeing all these visions in your head, but there's got to be a different level when you're like, oh, there's this enormous head key lying in the middle of a mall.
Yeah.
What's that?
No,
like?
It's insane, because when you started getting pictures of all the promotional stuff that Netflix was doing throughout the world, I got to see pictures of the stuff that they made an installation in Spain and also in Brazil and also in Argentina and here in Chile and a couple of places.
Wow,
and
so
you
cool.
started like seeing the billboards everywhere. Even here in Santiago, we had a couple of billboards in the streets promoting the series and stuff like that.
That's
in
so exciting.
In Sao Paulo as well. So it was incredibly impressive. And in a way, it also says a lot about the how enthusiast was Netflix about the series itself, which is something that the showrunners mentioned us when they were producing the series. As soon as they started like showing the first cuts of the first episodes from the to the people from Netflix, they immediately got like a huge like backup and extra funding for some episodes and stuff like that. So they were allowed to do a lot of things that at the very beginning of the pre-production weren't sure if they were able to. And finally, they got clearance to do almost everything they wanted to. So it was amazing. And it's very, very surreal to see something like this to grow into a multimedia project of a scale like that with an international worldwide release at the same time. So it's very absurd. With my wife, we sometimes get to look back at this and laugh a lot because something that would have been impossible to dream about like 15 or 20 years ago.
Yeah. Now, since it's come home,
this thing.
Yeah. since it's come home to you, do you bump into people who are like, "Hey, I saw this billboard. Is that you?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that the thing you did?"
Got a lot of messages from people from back from school that were taking this thing, and people that emailed me, people from the university and the family. I have a very extended family. I have probably cousins that I haven't ever seen in my life because there are so many. But everyone was really enthusiastic about this, and the media over here in Chile was very interested in this. We got a couple front page like headlines in a couple newspapers here that I remember when Carlton Hughes was promoting the series here in Santiago. In I think it was in mid January, he was very impressed of the coverage that we got in the newspaper. Yeah. So it was like very, very strange. And then also comments from a couple like nephews that say, "Why is Uncle Gabe showing up on TV so many times?"
They're mad about it. They're like, "What are you doing on TV, Uncle Gabe?"
Yeah. So be honest, did you come with reasons to keep driving by the billboards and be like, oh, there's my billboard again?
No. Luckily, I was busy enough doing work in order to prevent myself to a self-embarrassment situation like those. So yeah. I got to appreciate my slavery to the work in a way that saved me from making a fool
from
of
yourself. Exactly, from your ego. Because Pete's envisioning driving past his billboard someday over and over again.
To respect my paramedic job now, so I have to.
That's true.
With my
I freaked out when I saw you on screen, man. I absolutely
freaked out.
Myself
as well.
Yeah. Now, as a classically trained actor like yourself, I'm sure we can talk about sort of the trade and really how you got into character.
I've heard lots of your hints in several podcasts previous to that,
Thank you.
I think it was. I'm from the Justin Styler School of Acting. I hope not having disappointed the master too much. I try not.
Yeah, how do you rate him?
Polish my skills a lot, but
you were perfect. I actually feel like I need to ask you for some tips on like really being, because obviously you aren't an EMT, but you really were one on screen.
Yeah, I believed it.
How was that experience like? Can you tell us about the process where they were like, "Hey, we want to have you do this"?
Yeah, well, it was incredibly fun because, like, when they started like shooting, they were thinking a month or so of shooting the series. We got an email from Carlton Hughes and Meredith Averill, the showrunners that were also part of the writing team. And they told us that they wanted to write us as the paramedics as we did in the comic book. So they asked me if I was available to make the trip to Toronto to shoot the scenes and everything. And of course, I'd say yes. And from then on, we started coordinating this stuff in a way in which Joe and my schedule could fit in the shooting process. And we got in contact with Vincenzo Natali, who was going to be the director of that episode as well. So it was an entire surreal, absurd experience to get over there. Just to do the paperwork to be able to legally act in Canada was insane enough. Because
Oh, wow.
I had to fill a very insane, like, work visa for a couple of days full of amazingly fun restrictions because I was allowed to do that job and that job only for those dates only. But at least I didn't get the masseuse work restraint that Joe got in his work visa when he applied to do it. So I feel in a way they realized immediately what the differences between Joe Hill and myself were when they were preventing us to work.
When you say masseuse,
he makes most of his money. That's how he makes most of his money, is as a masseuse.
Right.
I don't know. I don't know which information does the Canadian custom have on Joe, but that's what it said in his work permit. So I'm just telling the official information.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for being honest with us. We appreciate it.
I know that's a very important insight to realize what it was to get there. Yeah. And once we get there, we did like the entire thing. We had to do the wardrobe testing a couple days earlier.
Oh, wow.
And then we got our scripts to rehearse the lines because we tried to apply this Anthony Hopkins concept that you have to say your line like 160 times in order to be able said it properly. And of course, for me, it was a disaster because of the accent. So I had to do like 300 times. And even yet, Carlton Cuse has to adapt the line for me because in the original line, I should have asked Rufus if he was comfortable. And comfortable is a nightmare for someone with a foreign accent.
That's so funny.
Then I changed my line to, "Are you okay there?" which is a much friendlier way to.
Yeah.
Let me explore my acting skills, folks.
Look, you just said it again, and I believed you again. I am okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for asking.
And the other thing that's incredible to realize in the process of the making of a TV series is that if you saw the episode, you realize that both Joe and myself appear like for about 3 seconds on screen, like 1.5 seconds each of us. And in order to record that 1.5 seconds, we spent on set like 6.5 hours.
Yeah.
Not
even
more. Yeah. We started shooting like at 6:30 p.m. and we ended almost at 3 a.m. in the morning. Because we had to wait the shooting of the scenes with the kids that needed to be released earlier because they had like a limit of the time in which they could stay working. And then you realize how many times you have to say, because we had to say our lines like 50 times because we needed to do the dialogue in every interaction with the young actors. Mm-hmm. So we said our lines when they said there and they were shoot. So for each one of the different cameras using in the shot, you have to do like 10 times. So it was like 80 takes of the scene from the focus on different actor and everything.
At what point did you start to feel like a crazy person? At what live reading of Are You Okay, Rufus?
Well,
like,
luckily, my work in comics has allowed me to feel like a crazy person.
That's the training. That's
so
method.
From that point of view, I was quite adapted. But it's insane to realize how much effort gets just to shoot a few seconds of a TV show and then realize that the actors and the people that do this actually professionally, they have to endure this process in which they shoot like just a couple seconds and cut, just a couple seconds and cut, and just a couple seconds and cut. And then when you see the entire thing put together after the editing, you feel that like they have like an emotional continuity and they get into the character all the time and everything. And to keep that consistency is certainly an amazing display of professional work. It's insane. So I'm much more like in awe of the people that work in cinema and TV after seeing how complex difficult and slow and painstakingly this process is. It's amazing. So.
But when you say that, it reminds me of like drawing a comic. Like you're carrying an emotional thread through a series of panels that are disconnected, and you have to tell the story in different pieces, in different frames that don't match. You know, it's not fluid in the same way. So do you feel... I actually think the way you described it, especially right there, it's painstakingly similar to what you do for a living.
Well, there's a certain similar vibe that's very real. And I think this is something that we discussed in conversations with Carlton and Meredith and with Vincenzo and other people from their production, in a way that even though both mediums deal with different tools and have different like storytelling options and alternatives in the way you tell the story, the way in which like to have to keep the mood in your mind and in your creative process is very similar. Like you have to be able to get in and out of it in order to keep your like your everyday life is still functioning, but you have to be able to have, like this emotional memory and this you have to be able to get back into the drama of the moment that you're displaying or creating in the same way. So it's very interesting to see a similar creative process done with completely different tools.
Yeah.
So what was more difficult then? Was it more difficult to play an EMT on screen or draw yourself as an EMT in the comic book page?
Certainly, it was less difficult to draw myself as an EMT because I can disguise my limitations more easily. I was pretty convinced that after they shot us as EMTs, they were going to like CGI us in an upgraded version of ourselves. So I was hoping to be this hot Latino EMT.
Sure, you should have been shirtless, right?
Yeah. Ran out of budget and they had just to leave us like we were. And I hope we didn't.
Practical effects.
Yeah. They had to edit out your abs. They were like, too much abs.
Too many abs.
Too many abs. He's too hot. We can't, he's distracted. Yeah, this is an emotional moment.
Yeah. Popular. Now, what was your, I mean, since you were coming to this, and we certainly talked about this a lot on the podcast, that there were so many changes, and particularly at the end, and, you know, just twist on twist on twist. The biggest one for me at the end that almost intrinsically changes the show going forward, and I am excited to see it on the show, but I'm curious to get your take, is the fact that there's now two demons. There's Dodge in the guise of Gabe, but there's also Eden, who's been hit with a bullet, which felt like that thing that you and Joe held back on until the very end of the comic book. But now here we are at the end of season one. What's your take on that?
My take on that is that Carlton and Meredith and the team had a very strong idea of what they want to do with the show in the way they want to explore the mythology of Lock and Key. And if everything sticks to the plan they have for the entire series, I guess you'll figure out that it's going to make a lot of sense for you. I guess they're trying to exploit the way in which you can develop a character in a TV show that's completely different than the way you do it in a comic book. Mm-hmm. And also based on another decision they made that I think it was pretty smart considering the format in which they were working, in which they... It's insane when you compare, for example, the first run of the comic book with the first season of the TV series, the amount of mythology that they crammed in this first season is, it sets the stage for a completely different dynamics than the way in which we did it in the comic. Because if you recall in the first run of the comic, in our first season of the comic, we introduced like two keys and a half. Yeah, maybe, and that was it.
Movies,
we were holding ourselves for later because, especially in the second arc, in which basically we included one extra key, which was the head key, which was so complex to display in comics the ways in which it worked and how it would affect the story, that we needed that room to explore that. But here they introduced like 10 different keys in one season in order to be able to have more tools to get like more playful with this. Because one of the things that's very important to have in mind is that the vision that Carlton and Meredith had for the show was to make this almost like a family-friendly TV show as close to a family friendly that you can get from something that was created by Joe and myself. This is the best effort anyone can get to make one of our stories into a family friendly thing. So I'm very happy with their approach. I understand what they're playing with these dynamics, and also because they wanted to have a very different way in which to approach the development of the villains of the series, because they want the series in that aspect to be able to surprise the people that's familiar with the comic book. So yeah. Their entire approach to the way in which Dodge presents itself and develops his or her relationship with the characters is completely different than in the comic book. The fact in which that they develop a way in which to have a final twist in the last episode, in the way in which Dodge has been interacting with the characters, is completely different than the comic. Because in the comic, we reveal that to the reader at the very beginning, and then we hide that for the rest of the characters of the story throughout the comic. So yeah. we rely on creating that tension for the reader because the reader knew the information that the characters didn't have. And in the TV show, it was more fun to subvert that approach to the villain in a way to be able to surprise the watchers of the show. So I guess this thing of having two demons at the end of the season certainly creates a surprise dynamic for what's going to be the next season. No one knows how that's going to be developed in the next seasons of Lock and Key. And I think that's what was, in a way, a sort of a very creative gift to give to the people that's familiar with the entire Lock and Key story and wants to be as well surprised by the TV show.
Yeah. Pete, were you going to ask a question?
Yeah, well, a couple things. First off...
No, here it comes. Here it comes.
As someone who loved the book so much, I was so stressed about not liking the TV show. But
I could tell that because I listened to each one of your episodes of the podcast. So the entire run of the podcast for me was to figure out what was going to be Pete's reaction throughout each episode.
So that's me too. I'm also doing that.
That we made it.
He's the canary in the coal mine, for sure.
Absolutely.
But I got to say, though, that I really appreciated the artistic choices that were made. The fact that we had beautiful shots, smart things happened early that teased us, because the comic was so layered and there were so many artistic choices being made, the way you guys kind of pushed boundaries with stuff in the comic. I was really impressed. I was worried that the TV show wouldn't kind of capture that heart or capture the smart kind of stuff that is we're playing chess, this isn't checkers type of thing. So I was really, really impressed. And to what you're saying, as far as the tension, the comic book did have more tension and the TV show played with that. They gave you tension. They took it away. Everything's fine. No, it's not.
I enjoyed a lot that the TV show has a playful quality that's different from the comic and gives its own personality to it. So I'm very happy about that. And I think that's something that was really a great hook for a younger audience for the TV show. Mm-hmm. One of the things that thrilled me the most that watched the entire season is that I watched it with my 15-year-old kid. And he was so into it throughout each episode that I was thrilled. So it was great. And even though that we get the chance to see it, it's still with no subtitles. So we just have to watch it in English. Mm-hmm. And even though despite that, he was sucked in by the action and by the storytelling, and especially by that sort of playfulness.
Was he well, that's so much better than those dumb comics, Dad?
Hey.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No, he was so into in the teenage dynamics of the different friend teams in the show and all that, but also very impressed by the way in which the TV show portrayed the magic of the comic. He was, for example, very impressed with the solution that they figured out for the head key, because basically was in terms of concept the most difficult thing to adapt to a different medium, and I was very impressed by that, but seeing other people that's familiar with the comic figuring out that, okay, this is so different, but it works as well as the original source, considering the limitations that one media has against the other.
Outside of the head key, what's one visual thing they did that was different than the comic that really surprised you, caught you off guard, or were like, whew, that's good thinking?
I think in a way what really caught my attention was how the expanded cast of the TV show felt like part of a Lock and Key mythology in a very natural way. I think the changes like they did in the new characters that they added or the ones that they mashed up or stuff like that were choices that made a lot... It never felt like out of the world of Lock and Key for me. And that was very refreshing to realize. In a way, it's not about which character you portray, but the way in which you display their dynamics, what makes it to be part of the story. And I think it was so well captured and so well done. And in a way, how that's what when I read like the first couple scripts of the series, and when I saw the first cut of the first few episodes with Joe, we immediately realized like this is such a different take on the world we created, but this is so the world we created at the same time. Yeah. That was fascinating. And I think in a way, Key House itself is a very good reflection of that, because I'm very surprised that people say, this looks so much like Key House of the comic. And if you look at it carefully, and I can do that as I'm an architect,
yeah,
it's so different. But being so different is so respectful of the spirit of the original design and the way in which it worked to create this world, that it's perfect. So I'm not surprised at all that people think that's even more closer to the original than it actually is, because it captures that vibe. And to capture that storytelling vibe, I think, is the secret for this.
The cave looked like it was pulled straight from the comic. That was unbelievable.
The cave was amazing, and it was really fun to read people thinking that they used the location that we used as inspiration to create the one in the comic, and it was totally not that, but it was so well chosen that I can see why people got that appeal. But yeah, get to see things like the cave or the Omega Door itself brought to life almost exactly like it was designed in the comics. Same with the well house, for example. That's done.
Oh, that well house is creepy.
And the keys themselves, it was very weird. I remember when I went to the visit on set, in which we get to the studios in which they were shooting the interiors of Key House. And when I got to see all the woodworks and when I get to see the small Key House logo carved in certain parts of the architecture, that was insane for me. It was like being inside your drawing brought to life by other people. It's nuts.
It's like you using the head key. You walked into your head key.
Well, I think Carlton said me that. This is like walking into your own head key. And I said, luckily, it's not, because this is like the happy part of my head key. You don't get to see the dark part, because I think in a way, I don't know why, but I think Meredith Averill was the one that decided to call the new villain disguise of Dodge as Gabe, which makes a lot of sense for me. But I don't know if for anyone else, because Well, I'm a Gemini. There's a part of me that you...
There you go.
Yeah,
you might be Dodge. You might have just used the identity key already and changed yourself.
Don't with the creepy eyeball.
I'm just saying.
In season three, you're going to see the EMT using the identity
key. The EMT became the villain.
Don't do it to me. Don't do it.
Yeah.
And of course, we were talking about this on Twitter. There's going to be the Matheson EMT spin-off.
We're very into it.
Are you going to have to
start like piecing in with the idea, and he got it immediately, and especially by my pitch that this should be the paranormal version of Flight of the Conchords, and that's the huge part. I'm even considering doing a couple of songs, but I have to see if Joe is up for it too. I think it's going to be
That's amazing. I will definitely tune in. This is somewhat similar to something we asked you before, but I remember reading an interview with Joe after the Fox pilot where he was talking about the memory tree in there and how he was like, "Ah, man, I wish we had thought of that. That's such a good idea." And obviously there's a form of it that made its way. I don't know if it was the Hulu pilot, but it definitely made its way here into the Netflix series. Is there anything like that, since you are working on more Lock and Key coming up, where you watch this Netflix series, you're like, "Oh man,
man,
oh, that's something that we really got to like steal and tweak and do our own spin on"?
I'm not sure if I feel it like that, but I think in a way, the way in which the show is different from the comic, it's a big relief for me, at least as a co-creator of the comic, and especially as we want to do more stories in the comic. Because I think that we can diverge as much as we can, and no one's going to hurt the other part. People is not going to be waiting to find the same things in these different takes on the story. And I think that that's a great relief. I remember when the people were working in the Fox pilot back in 2011, when we were still working in the comic book, I was still a bit worried that if this show aired and it became a success or not, as we were still developing the story, that there were going to be parts in which we could like start like giving problems to each other, because people could be eventually waiting like the same thing in two different medium and by different creators, and that could be complex. So I think it's very healthy for us all that the Netflix people is working with a story that's finished. And for us, it's refreshing to see these new takes on the things that we created, and even with a new spin. I think somehow they managed to merge, for example, certain keys into simpler concepts in order to be able to introduce like less keys than we did in the comic in the context of the show, because they need to like speed up the plot in a way that we didn't in the comic. We For example, we knew from a couple of years earlier with Joe that we were going to do February, the issue of February, in which we were going to introduce a lot of keys in just a single issue of the comics to be able to have like all the keys that we needed for the finale of the story.
Yeah.
And so we have that solved in that way. But to do something like that in a more interesting way in a TV show, it's obviously better to be like dropping keys here and there throughout the development of the plot, and that's different. So yeah, I'm not sure if we're going to like take ideas from what I've seen. I probably we're going to have a way to find our own spin into this idea of the matchstick key or the fire key, which is something that's completely original for the show and we haven't tried yet. I have a couple ideas that I could deal with this concept in a different way. But yeah, it's great to see that. And for example, the memory tree key was something that was very interesting to see, because it's sort of like they mixed the concept of the thorn key with a new way to use it with trees and plants. And also using that to introduce the memory jars that we introduced in a completely different way in the comic, that was like so simple for the TV show and in a way so beautiful to watch at the same time. Because as Pete said, I think one of the things that's more rewarding from this adaptation experience is that they really cared a lot about the visuals of the show, and they had this astonishingly beautiful photography throughout the entire series. Also, they have this incredibly amazing, like very like filled with life score that it makes company through the development of the plot. And then you get like the entire cast and crew that did an incredible job. It was like at times seeing things that you can certainly notice as references, as direct references to certain panels from the comic, was great to see on screen. Yeah. But every time that they diverged from that was so beautifully done and so carefully done as well, that it was like equally thrilling.
Visually, is it hard to now that you've seen the show and you have your the characters that you drew, is it do they blend together a little bit? Is it hard to not see the actors as you're thinking about the characters going forward?
No, because in a way I have like a very healthy separation of each of them, because for example, one of the things that we talked about when we were talking with the creators of the show on set was the fact that they develop the way in which they develop the characters in the scripts of the series was adapted according to what they saw on camera that the actors could give. So the TV show Nina Locke is done in the way to exploit Darby Stanfield's skills as an actress, the same way in which Tyler and Kinsey and Bodie are developed in the way that Connor and Emilia and Jackson can portray the characters as well. And that's so smartly exploited throughout the show, because basically they were focused on giving the actor room to get their very best throughout the characters in the story, and also to find a way to exploit the amazing chemistry that they have with each other, that I think that's their thing, and that's something that they own in such their own right that I think it doesn't create like any conflict with the way in which I saw the characters in my mind, because I'm very aware that I sort of think that my Tyler is like the cousin of Connor's Tyler.
Oh, that's really funny.
Where it's like having a multiverse of Lock and Key coming to life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. It's like Earth 52 Lock and Key next to Earth 1 Lock and Key. It's really fun. And it's it.
Oh, I was just going to say to that end, we had Chris Thrile on the podcast. He, of course, was saying that you had a conversation at one point where you're like, we're going to be the only people to do Lock and Key, and that you've even tried other people doing covers occasionally. And in his opinion, it doesn't work as well as having you do the art. Let's say Netflix was like, hey, since it is kind of this Lock and Key multiverse, we want to do Netflix cast Lock and Key one shot. What, how would you feel about that? Would you be like, well, I still got to illustrate that. No, give that to somebody else. Where would that go in this hypothetical scenario?
Wow. Oh, well, I'm,
wow.
I'm very open to like a creative exploitation of good ideas. I'm not like selfish in terms to say like, this is my thing and no one should do anything unless I approved it. I think that's very stupid and nonsensical. Life's too short. One of the things that I realized when I turned 40 was that I'm not going to be able to draw all the comic books that I want to draw in my life. So I have to be like very responsible and smart if I have the chance to pick like the right projects to do, because that's all I'm going to leave behind when I'm gone. Wow. So from that perspective, when someone is interested in doing something new out of an idea that you have, and they have a different vision that could be something new to bring to the world and to share with other people, especially when we need like distraction and inspiration and sources of new, like encouraging and inspiring ideas, to be close to that is like stupid, because here is a group of talented people that's able to do stuff that I won't be able to do in my life. Why not let them do that and let people decide what they like the most or everything? And so I think it's every time that like you open a creative window, you have to exploit it. You have to give room to creative, talented people to do as much as they can, because A, we need that stuff to make like a better world for everyone. And B, each of us won't be able ever to do as much as we want to do, because sorry, we're limited. We're not going to be here forever. And we need to do like the best we can with the things that we got at hand, and that's it. So
sorry, could you say that? Could you say that again? I want to get that tattooed on my torso.
Yeah.
Because man, I need to hear that shit more
hope
often.
Recording properly, then.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell what was going on with Pete. Actually, I was watching your face for part of that.
Well, I just I was just really impressed by that, because like here's something that he worked so hard on, but he's going to just like let somebody else artistically. While he was saying it, I just shaking my head like, oh man, what an answer. What a nice person. Oh, part okay. of me wanted to be well, like, it's, suck it, Salps. You try to get him with like a gotcha question. Oh, okay. Will was like, yeah,
so I got to say, I correctly interpreted all of those emotions going on.
No, the thing is that I've read comments online of several people saying like, oh, I'm not happy with Lock and Key because this is not exactly like the comic that I love. And, mm-hmm. And what I think when I see this reaction is, why you want to have the same story twice?
Yeah.
To have right. this amount of talented people wasting their time doing again something that's already done, it's a waste. You need sure. creative people to be doing new things, or, new angles, new exploration, new perspective, because something new can come out of this that could be the inspiration for someone else to think their own stories, their own movies, their own books, etc.
Well, you need to feed some. Yeah, I agree with you. But somebody, I was almost that guy because I loved the original material so much. I was so moved, so enthralled. I felt so close to it that if you would mess with that, I'd cut you. You know, like,
but he's not, yeah. what are you doing? I think Gabe's point is that he's not. No one's messing with it. You have it. Oh, I mean, yeah, I'm gonna come and steal your copies from you, Pete. But that's just me.
Welcome to readers and people that want to reread it again. And also, I'm committed with Joe to do more Lock and Key stories because I knew that people want to read more. And we actually, luckily, we have more stories to tell. So I think our effort has to go in that way. And also another thing that everyone has to keep in mind, either in comic books or TV shows or whatever, or movies or music, sometimes you're going to try to do something new or an adaptation and you're going to fail. And that's part of the business as well. There's no guarantees that something that you're going to create for a story, for a movie, for a comic or anything is going to be always what you hoped it to be. And in a way, one of the things that got me more like thankful about the entire Lock and Key experience is that it became way more successful and like appealing than we ever expected it to be. And that's something that you can't plan. It's something you eventually can aim to and hope for it to be, but you have zero control on that. And sometimes you can make like the best story ever, but if it doesn't like come up like in the proper time, could fail. And ask Van Gogh, he made like a miserable living trying to be a painter, and now his paintings are like the most valuable in the history of arts in the world. And he was like unlucky for him in the wrong time, but lucky for us, he was able to do his work anyway. But then when you have these luck synchronicities in which the thing that you do that you think is the best that you can possibly do matches the time in which it finds its right audience, it's a gift. And you have to be very responsible and thankful for that.
All right. Well,
go ahead, Pete.
I was just going to say, you know, Zalvin didn't get you, but I want to try here. All right. So you're watching it with your son. It's you and your son. You're watching your show. I mean, how did you not just kind of elbow him a little bit and be like, see that? I made that. That was my idea. You see that? Yep. That was me. I was in there.
The other thing I try to be like very smart about is that I don't own this show. I'm very thankful that an amazing team of people inspired in my work did this incredible TV show.
Inspired by your work. You started it.
It's
it couldn't have happened without you. Work,
but I would never dare to take credit about their incredible work. It's like, if the show works, it's because all the talent involved in making this gave them very best. They were really in love with the characters and the mythology, and they found a way to translate that to a new medium. And this is entirely their success. I'm very happy for it, and I'm incredibly humbled that my work had the chance to inspire something like this. And I'm incredibly even more surprised that their work was so good that even my appearance on that at the very end didn't ruin it. So that says a lot about the craft of these guys.
Pete, right, I love that you thought that was a gotcha question when it was a compliment.
I wanted him to admit a little bit that maybe he bragged to his son at least. I mean, if you're going to brag to somebody, you know.
Yeah.
But
no,
also...
No, it was a,
you can't.
It was incredibly fun because, in a way, I'm very lucky that my kids are like really into my work. They see me working on this like every day of the year. They know how slow the amount of effort that's behind creating every single comic book. So I already, it's very meaningful for me that when they see like the collected books, they realize how much that means to have that completed. And then seeing this, and what a thing that makes me sort of like very proud and happy is see how like cool for them it is to say like to their friends, oh, you know, my dad did this thing and this is my my dad TV show and everything. And that was really fun. And the other thing is was like my younger kids didn't know that I was doing the cameo in the show. So even though the older know, but the other two that have like 10 years old and four, they didn't know. And we were when we were seeing the series and we get to the finale, I called them to get into the and watch the scene, watch what's going on. And when I showed up, they were like between like excited and really freaked out. That was a really fun experience. It was like, why are you there?
That's great. Where they're like, wow, it's Uncle Joe. Joe's there. Oh, that's great. Thanks for showing us, Dad. I do want to read, there were two quick comments from over on YouTube. Sure. This one from Boy Racer UK. The show made some good choices for TV. I love the head key treatment. And Aris910 says, to get my girlfriend into comics, I told her about Lock and Key and how the artist is Chilean. She is too. She tried it for you, but stayed for the art and story. Now she's ahead of me in the series. Thanks, Gabe. Very sweet comment. Oh,
well, that's great.
Nice. Yeah.
Well, too good. Over. That's
Before we let you go, I did want to ask you, since you mentioned, of course, you are working on other Lock and Key stories, and this is something that was announced between the last time we talked to you and now, you got a Sandman crossover story that's happening.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Can you believe how irresponsible DC Comics is?
Yeah. Reckless.
Don't know what they're getting into.
So I think there was something mentioned a while ago about this, that it might be like Chamberlain Locke designing a key to hell and then taking like a very Dante journey through hell. Is that still the plan? What can you say about that? What can you tell us about this crossover?
Since we did a part of the Lock and Key mythology connected to the Shakespeare's The Tempest.
J.T.
Sazerac?
Right. I'm the Shakespeare expert as the classical trained actor here. So whenever it comes up, Pete's trained to say my name.
You know, I had this idea of have a way to tackle the concept of the Divine Comedy in the comic.
So cool.
And I think we joked about this with Joe when we were in Pittsburgh for the shooting of the Fox pilot. When we fleshed out the ending of the comic, and I think that's like the first time like we sort of traded ideas of doing something like that, and then a couple of years after we discussed the idea of having this trip to hell for one of the Locke, but how fun would it be to be able to do it in the Sandman hell, because it has a story with a key and it has like a very interesting setup and you get into this very interesting take on Lucifer. And also the idea in the way in which we wanted to tackle guilt in the story that we were crafting for Lock and Key. So we're starting like pitching that idea between us and eventually knowing that it was always the chance to do that same story with our own version of hell if we wouldn't get allowed to do it with a crossover with Sandman. But then we got the approval from DC Vertigo to be able to use those characters and that universe as a frame to do this crossover with Lock and Key. And for both Joe and myself, is incredibly meaningful because in our teenage years, Sandman was one of the books that made us fell in love again with comics and realize how much like creative ambition you could put behind making a comic book and how insane you can go with a story and be able to tell something that's very human and very touching, and at the same time, like, creatively with an incredible span of freedom. So I think in a way it's our way to say thanks to Vertigo and to the works of Neil Gaiman and Alan Moore and Mike Gringenberg and Sam Keith and so many other wonderful authors that created those comics, and the editors that were behind it. I think in a way I owe a lot of my comics career to the inspiration that I got from the books that were edited by Karen Berger in the 90s. So in a way, for me at least, it's a way to say thank to her for bringing my interest back into comics with this kind of stories and this kind of approach. So it's great that the news is finally out and that I able to discuss this with you guys, because I was biting my tongue.
I think you were alluding to it a little bit when we talked before. It's so exciting though, because Lock and Key feels like it's sort of the cousin of a Vertigo. There's a Vertigo version of Lock and Key out there somewhere.
And the other thing is that Joe came out with a really smart approach to make this like blend of these two universes in a way that will make complete sense for the reader. So I think we are playing with this in a way that it will not feel forced for any of the elements involved. And that was something that interested us a lot. We didn't want to make the Lock and Key Sandman crossover just for the sake of it or for fanboying about it, but because the way in which we want to craft the story makes sense in itself. And that's what gets us like very excited for this. So also pay attention to the upcoming Lock and Key comic books, which are going to be like the prequel to the crossover, which is going to be a 2-issue stories called Impale Battalions Go, that's going to be around the Chamberlain Lock family. And for the avid reader, there's going to be hints here and there about what's to come in the crossover after. So get ready. The wrap-up of the Golden Age story of Lock and Key is going to be as kick-ass as we could try to make it. So fingers crossed that it's going to work in the way we want, but we're aiming there, and I think we're getting there. So
that's cool. Amazing.
I mean, I love the fact that we got the comic, then we got the show, and then we get to go right back to the comic for more stuff. This is really well timed. This is very exciting time to be a Lock and Key fan.
Yeah, somebody must be paying attention to that.
Weird. It's very weird.
Really glad that you guys are excited.
Yes,
yeah.
We are very excited.
Then attention to after we finish the crossover and when we get back for World War Key, I'm really committed to find a way in which there's a key that's going to appear later that I think may open the door for the return of Pete LaPage and Justin Tyler in the comic.
There we go. Definitely bend the arc of the story as much as possible to get to that.
Truly. That's what the people want.
We still need to kill Dr. Salvin and to do so.
Yeah!
Better characters to do that than Pete LaPage and
Yeah.
This is great. I'm very excited about this.
I appreciate your invitation.
If I have to do a single page about that myself, I'm going to do it. Even if we publish it online or whatever.
Amazing.
We'll find a way to make it work.
The dastardly death of Dr. Salvin.
I did to it. I suppose you sold one copy right there.
And the thing is, in the Lock and Key Sandman crossover, we're going to figure out that dead characters still hang on in the Lock and Key universe. So who knows?
You never know.
We'll see what happens. Maybe Matheson 666 can bring them back to life. We'll see what happens.
No. Let's not spoil that potential.
Okay. All right. Sorry.
That's the.
We're thinking Emmys in this.
Exactly.
And eventually, you're going to EGOT, right? You're going to go for EGOT the Emmy for the show. You release an album.
I'm going to take online training with Justin to be able to be at my acting level in the way that Matheson 666 demands. So this is going to be.
As we talked about, I'm an EP on Matheson 666 because I wrote a tweet about it. So I'll be there for the whole process.
Because I wrote a tweet about it.
Like EP, so it's going to going to be great. Yeah.
EPs have been earned for much
less. The moment in which Bryan Cranston's going to make a cameo and stuff like that.
Oh, wow. Talent negotiations, it's like my whole thing.
Before we let you go, other than Lock and Key stuff, I know you're always working out a lot of different things. Is there anything else you want to plug that people should check out?
Well, stay tuned for the new announcements that's going to be about Lock and Key releases. That's going to be something interesting. Be tuned next week for several Lock and Key news.
Ooh, next week?
Several.
Next week, maybe.
Okay, that's hypothetical.
The other thing is for people that looking for things to learn what we are on in lockdowns because of the sanitary environment that we are merged in, I did an online lessons for a website that's called Domestica with a K. It's a Spanish site in which you can learn like different arts and crafts by self-teaching with video lessons. And I did one about like learning how to create a comic book from the concept, then to the development of the script, and then to the finished pencil page. So anyone that want to check that could just search by Domestica and Gabriel Rodriguez, and they're going to find the online course. And everything else, I'm available for questions and company on Twitter at @gear_comics and in my Instagram as well. And always, sometimes like photobombing in the Lock and Key podcast from the Comic Book Club. So
I saw you're also doing some covers for Joe's a cover for Joe's Basket Full of Hess.
Yes, I did a cover for the last issue of Basketball of Hess that got announced. I'm not sure when the release is, but already DC Nation published that. And also, I just I got invited by the editorial team of the Batman Superman comic book.
Yes.
Cover that I just finished. I hinted a few details of it. I can't spoil the entire cover yet. And that's going to be announced soon for which issue that's going to be. So expect news on that as well, the fans of superheroes. It was incredibly fun to do that Batman Superman cover. And there are plans in the work that I hope to be able to share soon and can't say anything yet. But so far, be ready for more Lock and Key because I got news from Joe that very, very soon I'm going to have the script for Impale Battalions 1. And then we're going to jump headfirst to the Lock and Key Sandman crossover. So expect more Lock and Key for this year. We're working hard to have it available for you as soon as possible. Please have patience and mercy on the artist, which is a decaying old man and is trying his best to be as on time as possible. But, you know, I keep teasing and joking with Joe about how he finds ways to write each time a more impossible to draw script in each new story.
Oh, man.
So I'm already warned about the tasks that I'm going to face in the next few issues, but I'll try my best to be not as delayed as in other times. But anytime, I'll be posting stuff online to let people and my editors know that I'm working all the time.
You got to prove it constantly.
Be paying attention to that. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Gabe, thank you so much for coming on. Congratulations with all the enormous success of the series.
For inviting me to do this. It's incredibly fun to have the chance to share with this thoughtful insight with such qualified people that sense about all the nonsense that I say. So thank you very much.
You're the best.
Absolutely.
That both the Lock and Key books and now the Lock and Key series have the Pete Page seal of approval. This is way tougher than any comics code authority.
That's true. That's true. Like,
man, if we please this it. Man, we really did a great job.
You did it. You threaded the needle.
You're killing it.
couple of quick things to plug on our end before we wrap up here. If you want to check out more podcasts from us, comicbookclublive.com. Also, normally we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. However, that is now currently online. We are still doing it Tuesday, 7 p.m., streamed to Crowdcast and also streamed to YouTube. So you can check it out either place. Obviously, we have the podcast as well. For Lock and Key socially, you can check us out at Lock and Key Pod on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, iTunes, Android, Spotify, Stitcher, or the app of your choice to subscribe to the show and listen. And on iTunes in particular, please leave us a comment. Those help us out a lot. And hey, thanks for locking it up, Gabe.
It was a pleasure.
That does not get the Pete LePage seal of approval.
Nope.